listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll check out a new Wisconsin effort to provide a safe place for victims of sex trafficking. Now, after an Ozaukee County judge ordered the state to purge over 200,000 people from Wisconsin's voter rolls, the State Elections Commission is saying, not quite yet. Today, the panel failed to approve a motion that would have directed them to remove those names once the judge issues a formal written order. On Friday, Judge Paul Malloy ruled that 234,000 voters may have moved and need to re-register to participate in next year's elections. The matter stems from a postcard the State Elections Commission sent to those people in October asking where they live. Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, seeing as how we have votes, elections that are very close, 30,000 vote difference in last year's election for governor, for example, 234,000 could be kind of a big deal, it sounds like.
Yeah, you know, when you look at it in the context of, you know, 3.3 million registered voters in Wisconsin, 234,000 might not seem like such a big deal to some people, but we have had so many close elections in Wisconsin in recent years that folks are really talking about this being a really substantial thing potentially for the big races we have next year, like the state Supreme Court race and, of course, the presidential election.
Let's take this back to the beginning or beginning-ish. Laurel, what was this lawsuit? Why was it brought before a court?
So this is a lawsuit brought by the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, which is a conservative advocacy group in Wisconsin. And essentially what they're arguing is that the State Elections Commission hasn't been maintaining its list of registered voters, its voter rolls, we sometimes call them, in accordance with state law. So Will says that there is a state law that requires the Elections Commission to remove people from the list if they don't respond to this state postcard that they send asking them to confirm whether or not they've moved within 1 month. Now, the Elections Commission has been waiting under current policy up to 2 years to remove some of those people. So that's kind of where the crux of this lawsuit is how long you wait to remove these people who may have moved in Wisconsin or may have moved out of state from the voter rolls.
And not everybody in the state gets these postcards. You have to have, not voted or something like that in a certain period of time. What else makes someone get this postcard?
So the reason that you get this postcard is actually you're flagged by this group called ERIC, which is a national consortium that different states join. And the way ERIC flags people is by them using a different address when they file some form of government paperwork. So if you notify the post office that you have a change of address, or maybe you register a vehicle with a different address than you have previously, ERIC will flag your information and send it to the State Elections Commission and say, hey, we think this person may have changed their residence in Wisconsin. Why don't you check with them and see if they still live there or if that's somebody that is, sometimes a phrase that's used is bloating. That's somebody that's bloating the voter rolls because they're not actually at that place anymore.
Talking to Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter, about a lawsuit and a court ruling that could take a bunch of people off the voter rolls in Wisconsin. So, Laurel, what is the judge here saying in this order?
So what the judge said was that Will was essentially right in their lawsuit that the state law does require the Elections Commission to remove folks if they don't respond to the postcard within a month. He said that the Elections Commission, if they want to do things differently, they need to go to the legislature and ask for the law to be changed. The argument from the Elections Commission is actually that there's another state law that gives them more discretion over how to handle this voter registration list and how to handle the information that they get from ERIC, that national organization. So really the argument from the Elections Commission is we have this other state law that trumps the one that Will is citing in the lawsuit, but the judge agreed with Will that they need to take action within a month.
And we had some kind of action on the Elections Commission today, and that was, I guess, to not take action. What happened there?
Right. So what happened there is they met to talk about the judge's ruling that came down last week and basically had a 3-3 partisan split on the Elections Commission. These commissioners are appointed by different leaders in the legislature and the governor. And essentially what happened is they voted 3-3 about what to do, whether or not to move forward with different things. And so it's a stalemate. They're not going to do anything.
And I can say this phrase for many stories in Wisconsin, Laurel, an appeal is expected?
That's absolutely right. So an appeal is expected. That'll go up to an appellate court. The first ruling was in Ozaukee County Circuit Court there. A lot of legal watchers of this case are completely, fully expecting it to go all the way to the state Supreme Court.
And for people who end up removed, if they end up removed from voter rolls, that doesn't mean they can never vote again. They would have to just go through the registration steps again. Is that right?
Absolutely. So say you move, a postcard was mailed to your old address, you don't respond, you're removed from the voter rolls. Wisconsin has same-day voter registration. So you could go in on election day as long as you have your ID and proof of your new residency. You can register to vote on that day and it won't affect you at all.
We'll watch that one progress through the courts. Laurel, wanted to touch base on another story going on now, Foxconn and the state subsidies, the tax credits. The Evers administration reportedly saying, you know what, Foxconn, the plans have changed so much, you're no longer eligible for subsidies as they were originally agreed. What's going on?
So what's going on there is that the Foxconn project has kind of evolved over time. They've changed a little bit about what they're planning to make at the facility, potentially what kind of facility that they're going to build. And so the conversation there is whether or not the company is still in compliance with the original contract that the state signed with them. The original contract actually mentions a specific kind of facility, a generation 10.5 facility. And so some folks are saying that because they're not building that specific kind of manufacturing plant, they're outside the terms of the contract, and therefore the state doesn't have to pay out any of those incentives, even if they meet certain job creation benchmarks. Now, Foxconn has said they have acknowledged that they're in talks with the state about this, but they maintain that they are fully in compliance with the deal with Wisconsin, and they're expecting to meet the first job creation benchmarks that they submit and start getting some of those incentives.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio's state capitol reporter. We talked with her about the 234,000 people who could be removed from the state's voter rolls because they may have changed their address. We also touched on a disagreement between the state and Foxconn over tax credits. Coming up, a new safe house in southeastern Wisconsin aims to provide shelter to young women who have been victims of sex trafficking. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a 1920s former schoolhouse in southeastern Wisconsin has been converted to a new mission, providing shelter to up to 20 survivors of sex trafficking. We'll get the details coming up. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a unique group of fans that recently got together in Milwaukee.
When My Little Ponies first popped up in the 80s, they were so cute and colorful. You couldn't escape their cartoons or toy commercials. My Little Pony returned to TV about a decade ago, spreading messages of love and friendship. And shortly after, a die-hard following formed around the ponies. Fans recently gathered in Milwaukee for a My Little Pony convention. WPR's Corey Hess takes us there.
Matthew McConnell and Dan Asta recently became buddies. The two met just a few months ago at BronyCon, the biggest My Little Pony convention in the world. After striking up a friendship there, McConnell and Asta decided to head to Milwaukee for the 6th annual Ponyville Cider Fest. Asta says the conventions bring people together with similar passions.
Everyone's so friendly. It's so hard to have a bad time here.
Dozens of My Little Pony conventions take place around the world. They started popping up after a revamped incarnation of the 1980s My Little Pony franchise was launched in 2010.
You gotta share, you gotta care. It's the right thing to do, and there'll always be a way through.
The show, called Friendship is Magic, appealed not only to little kids, but has drawn a cult following of teenagers and adults who call themselves bronies. McConnell says he was just getting out of the military and playing a video game online when suddenly a post about the ponies popped up.
Got me curious. Started watching some episodes. I'm like, okay. Well, I'm just watching a couple more. And basically got hooked, and here I am, you know, decade down the road almost.
McConnell was one of about 1,300 men, women, and children who attended the Milwaukee Convention. According to Visit Milwaukee, the three-day event brings in more than $500,000 to the city. The crowds come for the music. There are dance parties nightly. And the vendors. So many of the fans are artists who sell handmade t-shirts, posters, and wood carvings. But the real draw is the talent. At this year's Ponyville Cider Fest, actors from the show, directors, and cartoonists held panel discussions. There's some after-hours adult-themed events, too. Cody Miller, who also goes by the name of Vivid, is a program director for the Milwaukee Festival.
In any fandom where you're going to have adults, there's going to be people who have some sort of sexual representation with some of it. I think the vast majority of the fandom is, no, that's not the case. But people are going to enjoy it all sorts of different ways.
Miller says the conventions are an escape from the daily grind and a place to find mutual support.
You know, you look at the news today and there are so many terrible things happening in the world that it's nice to have a place where people genuinely want to be better.
That's evident when watching the show, which promotes harmony, generosity, laughter, and kindness.
Dear Princess Celestia, friendship is a wondrous and powerful thing. Even the worst of enemies can become friends.
We get a lot of mixed messages about what does it mean to be a man? Do you have to be hyper-aggressive and you have to be mean to people all the time and dominant and just kind of a jerk? And it's very refreshing to have a group of people who've all come together and said, no, that's not what we want. We want to be nice to each other. We want to be able to have feelings. We want to be able to enjoy something that's colorful and fun and not just the stereotype that's been pounded into our heads for years.
Jennifer Margroff of West Bend has been volunteering with Ciderfest for 3 years. She was recruited while dressed up as the Rainbow Dash Pony at Pride Fest in Milwaukee. Margroff says she watched My Little Pony when she was a kid and again with her niece as an adult, but she doesn't consider herself an official brony. Still, Margroff loves Ciderfest.
I think it's awesome because, like, even people who aren't into My Little Pony feel like they can come here and sort of just, like, let the weird out and, like, feel comfortable in settings where otherwise maybe they wouldn't be.
BronyCon ended its run in Baltimore this year, but the bronies will be back in Milwaukee in 2020.
WPR's Corey Hess brought us that story on Ponyville Cider Fest in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, after over 2 years of volunteer labor, a former schoolhouse in southeastern Wisconsin has been furnished to serve a new purpose. It's now a safe house for survivors of sex trafficking. Sex trafficking is the second largest organized crime behind drug trafficking. Nearly 100 incidents of sex trafficking were reported in a little over a year from 2016 to 2017 in the state of Wisconsin. Those are just the formally reported cases. Sarah Fraser-Piskor is the director of residential programming for Sela Freedom, a national organization with a mission to end sex trafficking and bring freedom to the exploited. The new Wisconsin home is their largest open so far. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rod. Thanks for having me.
Your organization, Sarah, has opened a few of these types of homes around the country. Can you talk about the purpose and goal of these homes?
Yes, that's correct. This is actually our eighth home that we are opening in the Wisconsin area, and we are so excited to be entering into Wisconsin and already providing services in the area. So our safe houses provide restorative, holistic care for survivors of sex trafficking and sexual exploitation. And we do that here domestically. So we have homes in Illinois, in Florida, and then our newest home, which we're here to talk about today, is in Wisconsin.
And we'll get into the need for this and the purpose a little bit. But one thing that struck me in reading about this is you're really trying hard to make this not look like a clinic or an institution or a prison or anything like that. You want this to be a home.
Absolutely. We want these girls to come in and to look around and be like, wow, I feel so lucky to be here, because so many of them don't feel like they're worth it. They don't feel like they're worth more than what they have been experiencing. And these are little girls that by the time they're coming to us are 18 years old. But when they were little girls, they experienced abuse from a very young age. We're talking about 2, 3, 4, 5 years old. They were victims of sexual abuse and then oftentimes ran away from home in their early teens. And so they have been trafficked and they have gone through many, many years of abuse. So when they come into us, we want them to look around and feel like a home environment, a safe environment. And if, as you've seen, if you've been to our website or seen any of our pictures, all of our homes are very beautiful, and they are touched by love from all of our volunteers who decorate them.
Now, can you talk about the importance of having stable housing for someone in this situation, someone who's gone through maybe their entire teen years being trafficked?
Yes, absolutely. Many of our women, as I said, come to us when they're 18, 19 years old, but because they have been in this life and being trafficked since their middle school years or teens, they don't have access to many resources. They don't come from healthy, stable families, and they don't have the educational background. So most of our survivors who come into our program don't even have their high school diplomas or their GEDs. And they're just, when we started Sela Freedom back in 2011, there just weren't that many resources available for adult survivors of sex trafficking. And so they need a myriad of resources. And so when they come into our home, they get assessed. And obviously the most important thing is they are in a safe place. They get their own bed. They get access to medical treatment and medical care. And then we begin the therapeutic process. So they are assigned an individual therapist. They get trauma therapy. We also have horse therapy at all of our houses. And as they move on in the program and they start to get healing from all of those years of trauma and abuse, then we start to touch on the educational needs that they have. And 100% of our survivors who come into our program, they get their GED while they're in our program. Most of them start pursuing community college or college education afterwards. And then we work on getting them employment placements. So it really does take a while, and they need somewhere to live. And that's where our safe houses come in. They need somewhere to live, be safe, and get these resources while they're going through that process. And that could take anywhere from a year to 3 years that they're with us.
Talking to Sarah Fraser Peace Corps, Director of Residential Programming for the group Sela Freedom. They have a group of safe houses for women who have been trafficked through their teen years around the country, their newest and biggest in southeastern Wisconsin. Sarah, how do residents find you or you find them?
So that's a great question. And there's a variety of ways that we get connected to survivors. We have, aside from just our residential program, which I oversee, we have an outreach arm. And our outreach arm works closely with law enforcement in the community. They also go into the jails and they provide jail groups. They go out on the street, they do street outreach, and they're very much in connection with the other organizations or law enforcement that would come into contact with these survivors. So sometimes they're referred to us because, let's say, there was a sting or a bust that was going on at a brothel or at a hotel that the FBI or the state's attorney's office knew that this was going on there. And so there's a group of girls that are rescued. They will often get referred to us. Another way that they get referred is many times these young women are still getting arrested, even though they are really being trafficked and this is not their choice. They're still getting arrested for prostitution because, you know, the laws haven't always caught up with the times, and we're still working on that. So many times we will meet them in jail after they've been arrested or through court diversionary programs. Another way is through drug rehab programs, because a lot of times they are struggling with addiction because they're in this situation and in this life, and their trafficker has either got them hooked on drugs to control them, or they've gotten hooked on drugs just because of the horrific circumstances they have to go through. And so we will meet them wherever they are. And in those different ways of connections, we're able to make contact and then develop a trusting relationship with them and hopefully bring them into our homes.
I understand a lot of volunteers helped with the renovation project here, and you're looking for local volunteers to work ultimately with residents. Is that right?
Yes, that's a big part of our residential program, and it's a really exciting part. We offer mentorship programs through strong, healthy women in the community, because these young women, they don't have any role models. And so while they get professional care through our therapists and our counselors and our staff, we also want them to be able to make connections with people that can follow them in life, like mentors and volunteers. And so our volunteers that come into the homes, they work with the women, and sometimes they come in and teach them how to cook a meal. Another group will come in and do like an arts and craft with them or just have a movie night. But in this way, they're making meaningful connections with the women. And then our women get to pick who they want to be their mentors. By the time they graduate the program, each one of our survivors has four strong mentors who are usually women in the community who then follow them, hopefully, through their life and can be that role model that they may not have had through a parent.
This is new here in southeastern Wisconsin. What have you seen from survivors who have been through the program elsewhere?
Speak a little bit more about that. What have I seen as far as what they've gone through?
Yeah, what kind of results have you seen from the people who have been through the houses elsewhere?
Well, the really exciting thing I can share about that is so our Florida program, which we have four houses in Florida, and that's where we were really established, and that's where we've been the longest. We actually have many of our survivor graduates on staff with us, which is really exciting. So they go through our assessment house. We have a two-house model. We have an assessment house, then a long-term residential house. And then if they choose to do independent living afterwards, after they've been in that for 6 months, they can apply to work with us in one of our programs and be an advocate. So that's always a huge compliment to the success of the program. But then just in general, our success rate overall has been 75% of those survivors who come into our program do not go back into the life and do not go back into the history of drug addiction. But sometimes it does take more than one attempt. So we know that we're just a part of a young woman's journey. Sometimes she may come in and the first time it may be a little bit too scary for her, and so it may take three or four times before she makes it through the whole program and is successful.
Sarah, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Sarah Fraser Peace Corps is the Director of Residential Programming for Sela Freedom. She joins today to talk about their newest safe house location. It's in Wisconsin. It can house up to 20 survivors of sex trafficking. Coming up, we'll talk about the benefits of retelling our old family stories at the next holiday gathering. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 7 on The Morning Show, new reporting finds a lot of medical debt in the United States and a growing trend of hospitals and other providers using debt collectors to pursue payment. Find out more tomorrow morning after 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, a lot of us will be getting together with relatives at least one more time during the holiday season, and that means sharing old family stories, the kind that might have been told many times before. Some of us might roll our eyes at a story we've heard for years, but research shows that for children, learning those family stories can have a big upside, helping to connect them to their history and create a sense of identity. Cynthia Blakely is a professor of interdisciplinary studies at Emory University. Her areas of research include memory, memoir, and narrative. Cynthia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Well, you and your colleagues have worked on this topic. Before we get to the specifics, can you give us a big picture, what you see as the benefits, especially for kids, hearing those old family stories?
There are many benefits, really. And some of the ones that are most clear from the research are that children really develop a sense of belonging when they hear these stories, a connection to something larger than themselves, and they tend to have greater resilience, better family functioning, less anxiety, less depression. The benefits to children really are pretty clear in the research.
Well, I want to get an example. And in a recent piece in the Wall Street Journal looking at this, you shared some of your own family's experience. You and I think your daughter were both in the same piece.
That's right.
What was the story that you shared as an example?
I shared the example of my mother overcoming a lot of obstacles in her adult life, really. She had a very secure childhood, but a hard adult life that included alcoholism and anxiety. My father died when I was a teenager, and she was a waitress, and a seamstress. She didn't make very much money. I think she really kind of lost her way for a while, but in her 50s, she started going to AA. She decided to go to college. and started attending college courses and ended up developing a career through helping other people. And at 60, she got her first white collar job as a social worker, helping the elderly needy on Cape Cod, which is where I grew up in Massachusetts. And she said to me more than once that from 60 to 78 were the best years of her life. She felt professional and happy and contributing, and I found it incredibly inspiring. And I often tell my students, don't stress if your trajectory isn't a straight shot.
That's interesting. And I could see where that story could definitely be inspiring when we encounter adversity in our own lives. There are also those family stories that are, you know, just kind of goofy anecdotes and incidents that may not have a moral or a value. Are those also worth passing along and regaling the kids with year after year?
Oh, absolutely. I think that that brings some of the joy into being part of a family, into a child's life. And there are lots of stories like that that one could tell. And they might have hidden values that aren't immediately clear on the outset. But, you know, I think it's wonderful to tell any kind of story because it helps the child to have a sense of belonging to a group, to a family, and a family that not only includes the immediate relatives, but those who came before him or her.
Talking to Cynthia Blakely from Emory University, looking at the way we share family stories. Maybe when we get together at the holidays, you can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Do you have this? Do you have this kind of tradition where, you know, an old anecdote, maybe it's something inspiring about a particular relative, maybe it's just some goofy incident that happened at a past gathering. Whatever it is there something you tell again and again, especially to the next generation? Join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard Cynthia from Ellen on Facebook, who says there's tons of value in telling family stories. It's history, culture, and it teaches the youngsters how to be storytellers. Win-win, Ellen says. How about that last point, teaching younger people how to share stories themselves?
You know, telling stories, and again, the research shows that the more that parents tell stories to their children, the better children become at telling stories about themselves. It's a kind of narrative art that can be passed on. And children who are able to tell stories about themselves tend to have a greater sense of who they are and their place in the world. And they have greater self-confidence. They have better learning outcomes and fewer behavioral problems. So the way you tell a story and the frequency with which you tell family stories has a very positive effect on children.
I've talked to people on the show who have said that doing things like reading novels can be really good for us. They help build our sense of empathy. They help us step outside ourselves and understand the perspectives of other people here. Does this family oral tradition accomplish maybe a similar thing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And another story I sometimes tell is of my grandmother, who was abandoned by her mother and moved into her grandparents' home, but was ultimately put in an orphanage. And even though she had two living parents and grandparents, and she ended up in her later life taking care of foster children. She took in 17 foster children,
wow,
in addition to her own three biological children. Over 3 decades, of course, it wasn't all at once by any stretch, but she really took care of other children in the way that she had not been taken care of. And I found that a very redemptive tale, and it helped me to understand her reticence in offering affection or praise. And it, I think, gave me more generosity in my own attitudes toward her and realizing that she loved us in the very best way that she could.
You know, it's interesting when I think about it, we've had writing as humans for, what, 6,000 years, and even then not most of us. But we've had storytelling for hundreds of thousands of years. In a way, passing these stories on orally is kind of way more core of what we are as humans, right?
I think it's the way the brain structures itself, that that we don't know who we are outside of stories. and that the brain thinks in terms of stories. And so the best way to get quote unquote facts across is through telling a story.
Now, sometimes I think people will share the stories of the old times to say, you kids these days, you have it easy. Like that ends up being the moral of stories passed from generation to generation. Is that helpful in any way, or is that something we should maybe steer clear of?
I don't think it's helpful to attach stories from, say, your grandparents' past to what might be construed as criticism of children. I think that really backfires, actually. I think it's much better to simply share a story of one's own early hardship as a parent or grandparent without implying that, gosh, you have it so lucky now. And that the child is smart enough to eventually come to his or her own conclusions about what that story suggests about life, including her own life. So, no, I would never tell a story that includes an implicit or explicit criticism of a child.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Michelle is with us in Janesville. Michelle, hi.
Hi. So my family keeps a quote book, and we just write down silly quotes or silly things that have happened throughout our day-to-day lives. And then usually the quote book just gets buried for a few months, but then at family gatherings, we bring it out and we'll pick a few quotes from maybe 20 years ago and
wow.
Reread the quote, laugh hysterically, and then it ends up into a family story.
That's fantastic. Do any stand out for you, Michelle, that you would care to share with us? I know you may not have the book right in front of you right now.
Oh, I have lots. So hopefully my son's not listening. He's 17 now, but when he came home from school in first grade, he said, "Mom, we learned a new song in music class today, and you need a guitar and a tangerine." And we all said, "A tangerine?" He's like, "You know, that thing that you hit on your hip and it makes a clapping sound." So, yeah. And then we just remember other funny things from when he was in first grade.
Michelle, thank you so much for sharing that. I love that idea, the family quote book, and then they can go back 20 days or 20 years, Cynthia.
I think it's brilliant, actually, Michelle. One of the things I encourage my students is to write things down. We think we're going to remember really funny things or insights that we suddenly have about family dynamics or a fascinating story of a grandparent. But if we don't write it down, the chances are we will forget it. So I love the fact that you keep this quote book. I think it's a really valuable resource.
Thank you so much for that that story, Michelle. Cynthia, that idea that we're going to forget stuff, have we, you know, you think of like, you know, the bards in Ireland or the people telling the story of the Iliad in ancient Greece or Native American storytellers being able to tell these long epics by memory. Are we losing our muscle? Are we getting wimpy when it comes to remembering stories?
I think we are, and one of the reasons those stories were remembered is because they were repeated. And that's something that is very clear, again, in the research, that repetition is really important to remembering. We remember what we talk about, and we forget often what we don't talk about. And so, and social media makes it harder as well. It makes it both easier and harder. So you have this digital record of certain stories, but it's a bit more fragmented. And I don't know. I don't think it quite replaces the handwritten word.
We're talking to Cynthia Blakely right now, professor of interdisciplinary studies at Emory University. We're talking about the benefits of telling and retelling family stories, maybe during the holidays, especially for the benefit of younger relatives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think that hearing stories from older relatives when you were a kid was valuable? Do you still remember those stories? Do you still share them? When you have a family get-together, do you have some way of recounting what happened last year, last decade, last generation? Did you not want to hear these when you were a kid, but glad you did now that you've grown up? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Cynthia Blakely from Emory University about the importance and the fun of sharing family stories with younger relatives, maybe something you can do when you get together with family over the holidays, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you do this in your family? Do you have that story or stories that are retold maybe every year at Christmas or whenever you gather with family members? Is this a tradition you'd like to start or maybe bring back if you used to do it? Do you remember stories from when you were a kid? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dave joins us now in Silver Lake. Dave, hello.
Hi there. I'm a 33-year-old teacher. I've been teaching for, I'm coming up on a decade, and something struck me in what you guys were talking about, how she said that she would never use a story to condescend to children or try to teach a lesson to the children through a story, using it as a negative context. And through my teacher training, like, I learned that as well. Like, you should never do that. You should be teaching kids through positivity and only through positivity. But as an adult, I remember back to my childhood and frequently getting that. And as an adult with my own kids, I find myself having to hold back from doing that. I guess, how do we as a culture teach each other to not do that? And I guess, like, it's only like a building up kind of thing, but that's my question, I guess. I'm sorry, it's extremely broad.
No, Dave, thanks. That's really interesting. And I'm guessing Dave's not alone, Cynthia. Dave wants to break that cycle of the, you know, criticizing the next generation through stories.
You know, it's so hard, Dave, to realize that what you feel you need to say as a parent is not always what the child needs to hear. So, and sometimes you want to just say, listen, you have no clue how great you have it. But that's not really what they need to hear. What they need to hear, in my perspective, is something more like, you know, it was pretty hard for me when I was a kid, and I am so happy that we can make your life a little bit easier than mine was, because I wouldn't want you to go through all of those things that I went through. Or, I mean, it's not all negative, of course, but when it comes to that comparison of hardships, I don't know. It's really an accomplishment to be able to restrain oneself from saying those things. And I think parents find themselves at that juncture often. And it's just important to remember, what do kids need to hear? And that's more important than what I as a parent sometimes need to say.
Dave, thank you so much for that call. I appreciate it. We'll go back to our callers now. Deb is with us in Madison. Deb, hi.
Hi. I wanted to say that my grandmother was born in 1902 and lived to be 101. And I'm 68, so I was a while back. And she was a keeper of all the stories. And so at one point I said, when she was in her late 90s, I said, let's get those stories written down. And because she had lived through, of course, she lived through World War One. Her husband was a pilot in World War One, and she lived through the Depression, and she lost her mother through the Spanish flu epidemic of 1917-1918. Mm-hmm. And so we sat down, and over a span of time, she wrote the stories, and I gave her full editing rights. And there were a couple that she wanted left out, so I left them out. And then I said, I know your favorite color is blue, so we put them on some blue paper, and with her permission, I gave one to every member of the family.
Wow.
And then she and I also worked on putting together pictures, you know, old pictures of everyone, Aunt Gussie that she always talked about. You know, we labeled them and have a book of all the older relatives as well.
Deb, thank you so much. What a story. Cynthia, talk about, not everybody's going to go through quite the effort that Deb did, but that the effort of actually consciously collecting stories, maybe from an older relative.
You know, I encourage my students every semester to do that, to conduct an oral history with grandparents, with parents, aunts, uncles. Deb, I think it's phenomenal that you took the time to do that. And I bet you're like me and learn things about your grandmother and your grandfather that You didn't know. And that's one thing I tell my students. We don't know what we don't know about a grandparent or a parent. And we have to remind ourselves they had full lives before we came into the picture. And I think it's wonderful both for the grandchild and for the grandparent, because I think we all want to be known in some way. And one of the best ways to be known is to not only tell a story, but to have that story heard. An interested and empathic listener is really crucial to the telling of stories. And it sounds like you were that for her, Deb. And that was a real gift. She gave you a gift, but you also gave a real gift to her.
Deb, thanks for that call. We're talking to Cynthia Blakely from Emory University about the importance of sharing family stories, especially for the younger generation, maybe over the holidays. We'll go back to your calls now. Cindy is with us in Baraboo. Cindy, hi.
Hi. One thing that we started about 18 years ago was a Thanksgiving tablecloth, and everybody who is invited at Thanksgiving writes on the Thanksgiving tablecloth of the previous year, whether it be bad or good or something they experienced. And we find every year that we bring that out, people sit down and they just look all over that tablecloth for what was written and who was written about what, and when they were younger, who they were dating and they're not dating anymore. And so it becomes a family history of what we've done over the years and had people sitting at our table.
So you have a big collection now, Cindy, of these tablecloths?
Well, I've actually added on to that original tablecloth.
That one will never
go away.
Gotcha. I see. Cindy, thank you so much for sharing that. That's a creative idea, Cynthia.
Absolutely. It's phenomenal. I've never heard that one before. And that's a perfect example of establishing a family tradition. And it can be goofy or fun, but to have the actual tradition does so much for children, because that's what our family does. Our family writes down on this tablecloth. It's a way of belonging, identifying. I think it's phenomenal.
Thanks so much. Time for one more caller. Jacob is with us in Wausau. Jacob, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Jacob?
So it's not really quite family, but a group of my college friends, one of my really good friends from college, he compiles kind of all of our photos and videos from the previous year and puts them in a really well-productive piece of film, basically. And it kind of branches off to storytelling. And usually he compiles it together and shows it on a Friendsgiving. And I know she had mentioned earlier about social media kind of making it difficult to do that kind of stuff. But I think it kind of all depends on how you use that medium to do that.
Cool, Jacob, thanks. So friends, not family in this case, and using social media as the raw material to build the story, Cynthia.
Yes, I think that's absolutely one of the ways in which we develop stories about ourselves and who we are in the world, and that social media brings so much to the table in helping us to feel connected with people that we knew a long time ago, that we still know. And that sense of continuity over time and connections in the community, are both of those things are so important to our sense of identity and our sense of belonging in the world. So I would agree with you, Jacob.
Jacob, thanks a lot for that call. And Cynthia, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Cynthia Blakely is a professor of interdisciplinary studies at Emory University. Her research areas include memoir, memory, and narrative. She joined us to talk about the benefits of sharing family stories during the holidays, especially for our younger relatives. You can keep sharing your stories about your stories over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, young adult books are big business, and they're not just for young adults to read. We'll look at some of the best books in the genre for 2019, and you can share some of your favorites, past or present. There's a lot of news out there, but what do people actually see, hear, and read? The authors of a new report tells us what news caught the attention of American voters in 2019. And Dan Robinson from Simply Folk shares some great music for the season. That and more, it's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Keely Baltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, get some musical inspiration. Wisconsin's own Stephen Thompson from NPR Music joins the show for a look at some of the best music of 2019. You can share your recommendations. That's tomorrow at 6 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk to the Washington Post reporter behind the investigation into what's being called the Afghanistan Papers, a trove of thousands of documents, internal documents from the American military and diplomatic service during the war in Afghanistan. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.